Coming up, Kim Lawton looks at a top U.S. religious freedom priority, the reopening of Turkey's Halki Seminary. It was shut down by the Turkish government in 1971. Also, the music and spirituality of singer-songwriter Bruce Coburn.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernathy. It's good to have you with us. President Obama outlined his vision for the nation in this week's State of the Union address. Much of the speech focused on proposals to help working-class families and what the president called middle-class economics. He also highlighted a host of social issues and cited America's respect for human dignity.
That's why we defend free speech and advocate for political prisoners and condemn the persecution of women or religious minorities, or people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. We do these things not only because they are the right thing to do, but because ultimately they will make us safer.
Tens of thousands of Americans came to Washington this week for the annual March for Life. The weather was unusually mild, but this year's event was clouded by a new political controversy. Abortion opponents were upset after Republican House leaders delayed a vote on a bill that would restrict abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. Several female GOP members had raised concerns that the bill did not have enough exceptions for victims of rape and incest. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously sided with a Muslim prison inmate in Arkansas who had sued for the religious right to wear a short beard. The court said that Arkansas prison officials failed to show that the inmate's beard was a threat to security. The court's decision was immediately praised by Muslim groups as well as religious freedom advocates, including the Beckett Fund. Pope Francis concluded his trip to Asia this week. He received a warm welcome in the Philippines, where he met with natural disaster survivors, praising their faith and resilience. On his trip back to Rome, he generated some controversy when he remarked that Catholic parents did not need to reproduce, quote, like rabbits, although he reaffirmed the church's ban on artificial birth control. Francis also confirmed that his trip to the U.S. next September will include stops in New York and Washington, D.C., as well as Philadelphia. Anti-Islam protests continued throughout Europe this week, sparking fears about rising Islamophobia in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. In France, more than 100 anti-Muslim incidents have been reported since the shootings. Meanwhile, Muslims in many parts of the world held demonstrations denouncing what they see as offensive depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. In predominantly Muslim Niger, protests against the French magazine Charlie Hebdo turned violent when Christians were attacked and more than 70 churches reportedly burned to the ground. We want to talk more about some of the top stories of the week with Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, and Kim Lawton, our managing editor. Kim, the State of the Union. What do you hear from religious folks about what they liked and what they didn't like?
Well, there wasn't a lot of explicitly religious language in this year's speech. The president did say that the U.S. is against or concerned about rising anti-Semitism. He did say we shouldn't have stereotypes against Muslims as all of them being violent. But apart from that, he really talked about issues. But a lot of them were issues that people of faith care about. And so I heard from social justice religious people who were pleased by some of the economic policies. Some religious conservatives, not so much. On the social issues, one issue that really stood out for me was the gay marriage question. And the president really characterized gay marriage as once an issue that divided us, but now it's a matter of freedom and civil rights. Now, for the people of faith who've been lobbying for that to happen, who see it as a matter of justice, they were pleased about it. But a lot of religious conservatives, especially evangelicals I heard from, didn't like that language at all. And you know, this is an issue that's going to be, in the coming weeks, even more tense as a Supreme Court takes it up.
Yeah. Kevin, what did you hear?
Well, along the gay marriage front, the president characterized it as almost a done deal. He said, you know, 70% of our country now lives in a state that has gay marriage. And he was almost saying this battle is over. And a lot of evangelicals, mm-hmm. like Kim were saying, would say, no, not so much. What I thought was really interesting was how he tried to recast the values debate. You know, we've heard a lot in recent elections about values, and we had the values voters 10 years ago. But what he was talking about was not, you know, the typical hot-button social issue values, abortion and gay marriage, but the underlying American values and hard work and equal opportunity and things like that, and trying to sort of reframe how we look at values in this country. Really interesting, I thought, at the very end, and this was deliberate. Instead of saying God bless America, the president said God bless this country that we love, which I thought was subtle and significant, but also a very interesting change.
What was the difference?
I think, you know, a lot of times God bless America is sort of a throwaway phrase. A lot of people say that it's uber patriotic, that it doesn't really mean anything because it's everywhere all the time. This way was, it's not God bless America as a country as opposed to other countries. It's just God bless this land. It was much more inclusive, I thought.
Mm. And, you know, I also heard, by the way, from religious groups that felt that perhaps the president should have spent more time talking about the challenge of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which he never even mentioned. And a lot of religious communities saying, you know, look, we've seen persecution of Christians, Yazidis, other religious minorities, and the president didn't spend that much time on it. So I heard some dissatisfaction with that as well.
And what about the abortion thing? That came up.
Well, interesting politics as ever. A lot of religious conservatives, Catholics and evangelicals, many Catholics, were in town for the March for Life, recognizing the Roe versus Wade anniversary. And many of them said, hey, we got out to the polls in November. We helped elect a GOP majority in Congress. And look, right off the block in January, one issue we cared about, this abortion issue, which, by the way, never seems to go away, they were hoping for some legislation that got pulled. So, you know, at least for the time being, it shows that the Republican Party wants to reach out to these very faithful voters, but they also want to broaden their network with women and younger people who haven't been voting as much Republican, and they're concerned that being seen as being focused on some of these issues will harm that. But, you know, they have to balance those two constituencies.
And it was women in the House who
led
that.
Yes, yeah. So Republican women raising concerns about it.
Kevin Marcus Borg died this week, 72 years old, I think. Very controversial in his career with the Jesus Seminar. You reported on him a lot.
Yeah, so the thing about Marcus Borg was he was one of a number of really respected scholars who questioned everything we've sort of taken for granted about Jesus and Christianity over the years. And instead of getting bogged down in the doctrines and the theology surrounding Jesus, they looked at Jesus as a human. Now, obviously, that didn't, you know, that upset a lot of people. But what he was trying to do was say, let's cut away all of the debates we have around the historics and, you know, who said what and where and when and how it happened, and let's talk about the central message of Christianity. And yes, he was one scholar, but he spoke for a lot of Christians who have questions about that.
Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, and Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
In other news, during a trip to Idaho this week, President Obama had a private meeting with the family of Saeed Abedini, the Iranian-American pastor who's been imprisoned in Iran since 2012. The president told Abedini's wife and two children that the case is a top priority for his administration. One of the longest-standing priorities on the U.S. International Religious Freedom Agenda has been the reopening of the prominent Eastern Orthodox Halki Seminary in Turkey. It was shut down by the Turkish government more than 40 years ago. On her recent trip to Turkey, Kim Lawton looked at the school and the international efforts to reopen it.
The Theological School of Halki was once the world's leading Eastern Orthodox seminary, but it was closed by the Turkish government in 1971. More than 43 years later, the U.S. government and many faith-based activists around the world are still waging a campaign to see it reopened.
Halki is important substantively, of course, to the Orthodox community, but it is also very important symbolically to the world and to those concerned with religious freedom.
Katrina Lantos-Sweat is chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
This is perhaps the most obvious symbol of sort of false promises, broken faith on the part of the Turkish government when it comes to issues of religious freedom. We are very much in the posture of encouraging Turkey to step up and do the right thing, and it would strengthen, not undermine, Turkish society.
Halki is on an island about an hour's ferry ride from Istanbul. From the dock, visitors take a horse-drawn taxi to the top of the Hill of Hope, where the school was established in 1844 on the site of a Byzantine-era monastery. It quickly became a major international institution of higher education, with a library that boasted more than 110,000 volumes. Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, spiritual leader of the world's more than 300 million Eastern Orthodox Christians, was a Halki graduate, as were many of the top Orthodox leaders in the U.S. Orthodox officials say Halki's closure has had a profound impact on their church.
We were deprived of our right, of our ability to renew our clergy. It was a very big loss for us. And this lasts already 43 years. It's a long time.
Metropolitan Elpido Foros was born in Turkey, but as a young man feeling called to study theology, he says he had no choice but to do so elsewhere. He studied in Greece.
So when I finished my doctorate studies and I was elevated to a professor, again I had to go to another country to be a professor, because in my own country, my own school, my own monastery is closed, and I cannot do that, and I'm a citizen of this country.
Halki was shuttered during a time of strong pro-Turkish nationalism. Because of long-standing tensions between Turkey and its neighbor Greece, all entities perceived as having ties to the Orthodox Church or Greece suffered severe restrictions. Those sentiments linger in many quarters. Turkish officials have long said the school will not reopen until Greece improves the situation for Turkish minorities living there.
Greece had to do some steps to give some rights to the Turkish population in Greece. And then we asked ourselves why we are hostages from our own country for some possible difficulties that some other citizens of another country have.
Turkish government officials declined our request for an interview. Fatih Jaren of the Independent Journalists and Writers Foundation in Istanbul admits there seems to be little internal political will to see Halki reopen.
The issue has been politicized to a serious degree. It has been a subject to bargain between the Turkish and Greek governments, for example. You know, reciprocity. I personally believe the rights of my country should not be a subject of bargain in an international debate. It should be granted.
The Greek Orthodox community inside Turkey has diminished dramatically in recent years. Official statistics suggest there may be fewer than 5,000. They are allowed to worship, but Metropolitan Elpido Foros says true religious liberty is more than that.
The problem is to allow me to educate myself, to educate my children, to educate my family in a Christian way, to teach them our religion, to be able to educate the candidates for priesthood. And if this is not secured by my country, then my country violates my rights.
Halki's ongoing closure is all the more poignant for Turkish Christians because of the history surrounding them. For centuries, Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, was the center of ancient Christianity. But those glory days are long gone. The magnificent Hagia Sophia, once the most important cathedral in Christendom, is now a museum. And there are persistent rumors that it may be turned into a mosque, as it was after the Ottomans conquered the Byzantine Empire.
There are monuments that, when I visit them, arise in me some deeper feelings of pain and also of prayer to God that may heal the wounds of the past.
In the face of strong international criticism, Turkey's powerful former prime minister, now President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has indicated, including in meetings with President Obama, that Halki could open again. But he has not followed through, and the school remains closed.
He corrected many mistakes of the past. But still, there are so many problems. So if such a powerful president feels unable to open this school, then who can do that?
You wonder to what degree pressures from Islamist forces within Turkey are prevailing upon the government not to follow through on commitments that they have made openly, if not publicly. So I think that's a concern, because if that is the case, that they are responding to those sorts of pressures, that's not a good omen.
After decades of waiting, 3 years ago, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew appointed Metropolitan Elpidophoros abbot of Halki and tasked him with reestablishing a monastery and making it a living community once again.
We realized that we waited for a long time, and now it's a time for action, not to wait anymore. We lost 43 years waiting.
Nine monks now live on the grounds, overseeing a small farm and a garden where they're trying to cultivate all 88 plants mentioned in the Old Testament. Restoration of the buildings is underway, the library has been cataloged, and they have begun the mammoth job of digitizing all 110,000 books.
We are confident that someday this school will reopen, and we have to prepare ourselves for this day.
Despite no signs of that happening anytime soon, the Metropolitan says they're still moving forward in hope, a key tenet of their Christian faith. I'm Kim Lawton at Halki Seminary in Turkey.
Finally, we have a story about the Canadian singer-songwriter Bruce Cockburn. He spoke with correspondent Bob Faw not only about his career with many awards and albums, but also about his spiritual search and his sense of the presence of God, sometimes while he's performing.
Used to have a town, but the factory moved away.
He is not just a gifted guitarist and lyricist. Canadian-born Bruce Cockburn has also been described as a combination Bob Dylan and Gandhi, a modern-day prophet. Lauded for his genius with the guitar and his poetic songwriting, Cockburn plays a mixture of styles, folk, jazz, and rock. And when it comes to his music and his spiritual state, 69-year-old Bruce Cockburn has never stopped reaching for more.
I'm a seeker of a relationship with God, and or let's say of a smoother and more conscious relationship with God. I think I have a relationship with God, but I'd like to be more in tune with it. So in that sense, I'm a seeker.
At 17, Cockburn had a strong interest in spirituality and studied many religions, even flirted with mysticism, which culminated, miraculously, he said, with an epiphany when he felt the presence of Jesus on his wedding day with his first wife.
The sense of his presence was very strong, and it was a hymn. There's no question about that. It registered to me as a male presence that was loving and positive, and there was the sensation of light. So that was the basis of my becoming a Christian.
After that experience, Coburn's songs contained more religious images. He was labeled a Christian songwriter in the tradition of the prophets.
Heaven and earth are full of your light.
The lyrics in some of your songs just intrigue me. This is from Broken Wheel. So how am I supposed to feel way out on the rim of the broken wheel? I mean, that's you, way out on the rim of the broken wheel.
Yeah, well, the broken wheel is the galaxy we call the Milky Way, which is where we live. The song is really, I suppose, about a fallen world and my relationship to that fallen world. The song is about my own feelings of responsibility for the situation as it exists. And it's like, what am I supposed to do with this?
From Christian songwriter, he became a spiritual seeker, exploring various religions and getting involved in many causes as he traveled the world.
When I was living in Central America and I heard him giving voice to what we were experiencing, I just thought, wow, I've found this sort of spiritual poet that put war and conflict in really human terms.
Some of what Coburn tried to capture in his music, that need to reach out and find something greater, can be heard in his song, All the Diamonds.
Sun's up, looks okay. The world survives into another day, and I'm thinking about eternity. Some kind of ecstasy got a hold on me.
Sometimes, says Bruce Coburn, reaching out can produce amazing results.
Occasionally there is a feeling when I'm playing that connection with God is alive and functioning.
You feel like a conduit at that point?
That's a good word for it. When I feel like a conduit, I get that little shiver that is like, yeah, there's God right here now.
His spiritual quest, the ups and the downs, has now been chronicled in his first book with a title lifted from Coburn's song, Rumors of Glory.
Why the word rumors? What was it?
Well, because these are hints of things. You're not really seeing the glory, but you're seeing the suggestion of it, or the seeing a vestige of it, or these little bits of it leaking through.
And that's what makes you keep seeking, keep being open?
I think it sure helps. Yeah.
In a career which has spanned 5 decades, with 31 albums and numerous awards, in Canada, he's even on a postage stamp.
You're like me, you'd like to think we've learned from our mistakes. Enough to know we can't play God with others' lives at stake.
Now, says Bruce Coburn, in the pulling of notes out of metal, my job is to try and trap the spirit of things.
I don't spend much time thinking about trying to get a message across. I feel a compulsion to write about what I experience and what I think I see and feel. And then I have a compulsion of some kind to share that with people. I guess it's the conceit of every artist that, you know, you think that what you have to say is worth putting out there, that people are going to be interested.
And a compulsion, too, he makes clear, to being receptive to a mystery he does not fully understand.
I don't see how you can have a relationship with God that doesn't involve a state of receptivity. And a receptivity to lots of stuff, because God does show up in all kinds of odd ways. But there's all kinds of different ways that relationship can be made manifest. And it requires a state of receptivity to know that that's what's happening.
He has a different perspective now, he says, than in that earlier Christian songwriter phase. But what is not different, for Bruce Coburn, is his status as a seeker.
Spiritually, you're not now where you expect to be?
I don't make any predictions about that. I have hopes. Meaning my awareness of it comes and goes, and the energy that I might get from it comes and goes, and the lines, it's like there's a lot of static on the line, which I'd like to get rid of.
Is that your fault?
I think so. Yeah, I don't think it's God's fault.
But you're still listening or trying to listen.
I sure am, yeah. I think it's what we're here to do.
For Bruce Cockburn, the musical and spiritual journey never ends. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in New York.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website, including a feature on Turkey's most important religious sites. You can also listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Bruce Cockburn singing Lord of the Starfields.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.